The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Scott McCain. I'm the author of The Ultimate Customer Experience, 5 steps everyone must know to excite your customers, engage your colleagues, and enjoy your work. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Scott McCain to talk about his newest book, The Ultimate Customer Experience, 5 steps everyone must know to excite your customers, engage your colleagues, and enjoy your work, published by Forefront Books, distributed by Simon & Schuster. Scott McCain's experiences have been diverse and remarkable, from playing the villain in a Werner Herzog film that esteemed film critic Roger Ebert named as one of the 50 great movies in the history of the cinema, to being inducted into the Professional Speakers Hall of Fame, from having been chosen, along with Zig Ziglar, Dale Carnegie, and Seth Godin, as one of 30 members of the Sales and Marketing Hall of Fame, to a decade as a globally syndicated television commentator on the entertainment scene. It's not a stretch to say Scott McCain's life has been distinctive. He has spoken on platforms in all 50 U.S. states and 40 countries, and his expertise has been quoted multiple times in publications including USA Today, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the International Herald Tribune. And, interesting fact, Arnold Schwarzenegger once booked Scott for a presentation at the White House with the president in the audience.
Come on, don't bullshit me.
Scott, congratulations on the ultimate customer experience, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome back, friend.
Douglas, you are the best. I cannot wait to play that introduction for my wife. She says I put the stink in distinction. So this may change her attitude, I'm telling you. No, it's great to be back with you, my friend. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So longtime listeners may recall you were on in 2019 for episode 227 to talk about your previous book, Iconic. But, and this is what's going to go on Scott McCain's bio, along with the Sales and Marketing Hall of Fame. He was the very first guest on Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails.
Where's my bourbon?
And that was a limited time special show that was 66 episodes long. You were number one. And then, as people may know, my liver then needed a rest, and it got to be the summer of 2020, and it was time to move on. So that was great fun. But, you know, Scott McCain, you've written 9 books. You're one of a very small number of icons in the Sales and Marketing Hall of Fame. You're in the Speakers Hall of Fame. And what I want to know is, when are you going to break through and start getting the recognition you deserve?
Yeah, you know, I'm a 30-year overnight sensation, maybe. Huh?
When are you going to hit the big time, Scott?
You know, it's so funny you say that, Douglas, because I've got so many friends that are in the music business, you know, they're recording acts, and you talk to them, and people want to talk to them about their hits, and they're always like, yeah, but I've got this new album, and I got this new track, this new cut, you got to hear it. And they're always more excited about the new than what they've done in the past. And I used to not get that at all when I was a much younger person. And now I get it, is that what motivates you is what's ahead of you, not what's behind you. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm grateful for all the kind things that you said, but what really excites me is the future, you know, what the next book is going to be or how this new book is doing, and what can I do to spread that message? So it's really kind of interesting to be at this stage in my career where you look in the rearview mirror and there's some very nice things, but I'm more excited about what I'm going to see in the windshield.
You seem completely unfazed by any of that. So, you know, one thing I have to mention is that when you were the very first guest on Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails, the world was suddenly locked down, you know, and that's when I sent an email out to over 200 authors that by that time I had interviewed. And I said, hey, I'm thinking about doing a daily show because I'm, you know, we could just talk, didn't have to be about the book. And you know, I'm hearing from a lot of listeners who are going through some rough times. And I thought, what can I do that might be helpful? Here I have a son who's like a paramedic. He was really doing helpful stuff. So I thought, all right, I'll do this show. I sent it out to all these authors. And within 1 hour, I had heard back from over 100 authors.
Oh my gosh.
And they all said, Douglas, I, like you, I can't go anywhere. I'm not speaking. All my gigs got canceled. I'm already drinking. So yeah, I'll talk to you.
See, I thought I've spent all these years trying to build a brand. And the first thought was McCain, bourbon. Yes. Not exactly where I wanted the brand to go, you know?
And so things were just so, listener, think back to what you were doing, how strange it was. I know here in the United States, the Major League Baseball and the National Basketball Association had shut down. And we were all just wondering what's going on, and that's why the show ended up being really helpful for me, in part because it gave my family a break so they didn't have to keep talking to me. It was like Doug daycare, and my family thanks you, Scott McCain. But it was also interesting talking to people like you about what do you think's going on? And I remember a quote you told me from the famous, the late screenwriter in Hollywood, William Goldman, who said, "Nobody knows anything." And I had never heard that before. And I've since read up on what he meant by that. And that has really stuck with me. And I think that what we should explain, though, it doesn't mean ignore what we know tends to work. But here's a guy, he won Oscars for these screenplays, a phenomenal writer. And he would still challenge conventional wisdom. People would say, oh, that's never going to work. People aren't going to buy tickets to that movie. That's never going to work. But he would challenge conventional wisdom. And his mindset was, what do you know? I think I know what I'm doing. Maybe I'm going to fail. I have failed before, but I think I'm onto something. And what's the reason that's come back? That has come back in a couple of interviews I've done with authors. There was a book called Making Websites Win and also a book called Email Marketing Rules. And these are people who are experts on website optimization. There were two fellows in England. They'd received awards from the Queen of England for their work for these little-known companies like Amazon and Facebook and Netflix and so forth. And I remember one of the big takeaways from their book and from interviewing them is they said, basically, nobody knows anything. In other words, people want them to say, what's going to happen with this website? What's going to happen with this particular page? What's going to happen? And all they could say is, well, we need to test it. I mean, what are you trying to accomplish? I mean, there's a few things, but well, I can't tell you what's going to happen. And the same thing came up recently in an interview with Chad S. White, who's written probably the most definitive book on email marketing. And he's the same thing. He goes, you know, I think I'm an expert, but yeah. Even I don't know anything. I can't tell you what's going to happen. You just have to try it.
Exactly. We see that so much right now with AI. In that those who are, well, first of all, you know, it's amazing that many of those that were experts in pandemic diseases earlier are now AI experts today. You know, it's amazing that even those who are truly experts in the field are saying, we don't know where this is going. We just have to experiment with this. And I, you know, it's true with books too. Don't you think, Douglas? I mean, my great buddy, Mark Sanborn, Mark and I have been friends since we were teenagers, and, you know, with the Fred Factor is one of the biggest selling business books of all time, but it was first published through a little house in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I've got a hardback copy of that original book, and you know, you never know what's going to be lightning in the bottle. You never know what's going to capture the attention of your intended audience. So you just have to keep trying. You have to keep trying new things. I said at a meeting not long ago that death concerns me, but irrelevance terrifies me. And how do you stay relevant? Well, it's not by continuing to do the same old thing over and over and over. It's taking the knowledge that you have and taking the skills that you have and then trying new things with it and continually trying to grow and to learn. I'm a big believer in reverse mentors. I've got a guy in his 30s, early 30s. It's a mentor to me because I need to make certain that I'm relevant to that audience as well as the people that are my age.
Oh, interesting. And your comment brings to mind a quote attributed to the former U.S. Army Chief of Staff, Eric Shinseki, who said, if you don't like change, you're going to like irrelevance even less.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yes. So I can't get that idea out of nobody knows anything. And of course, a lot of people do know things. A lot of people know kind of what works. But I see this on LinkedIn a lot where people are, okay, 2 years ago, they were all crypto experts. This year, they're all AI experts. I don't know what's next, but there's this, occasionally I'll see somebody that doesn't seem to have, they may have had the humility surgically removed from them. And they're trying to tell us, you know, these people that are fashioning themselves as gurus or experts. So anyway, let's move on. I've got to say that when I find out that a book by a professional speaker is on the way, I know it's going to be good. And I am batting 1,000 on that. And there's books by you and Scott Stratton and Jay Baer and Shep Hyken and Joe Calloway. These are probably guys I think you mentioned in your book. These are all, I think all of those are Hall of Fame speakers. And I once ran into Jay Baer in a bar in Cleveland. So I asked him, was I onto something? And he said, yes. He said, I don't write a book until I've given the talk about 25 times. It's like the stand-up comedians that work on the material for years. You see a comedian on Netflix, they've been working on that almost their whole career, some of those jokes. Yeah. And so there's a sense of there's timing. You introduce the stories at the right time. There's humor. It's just, I know it's going to be good. So
I never thought about that until you mentioned that, Douglas. I'd never thought about that. But
really?
It never had occurred to me. But it really is, you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking about how difficult it must be for a novelist, you know, to set, because writing a book is a very solitary thing. Mm-hmm. And to sit there alone and not know how your audience is going to take a particular story or segment of your novel must be incredibly difficult because, you know, I put a story in the book and it's a story I've probably told in front of thousands of people. So I kind of know what, if I write it correctly, which is a different skill than telling it correctly to an audience, but if I can write it properly, I kind of know what the response is going to be because I've road tested it. So.
Right. And all of you have the scars that go because you know what bombs and you don't put it in your book.
If it doesn't go well on stage, it ain't going in the book.
Right. So I have to mention Scott Stratton. I've interviewed him twice. I've interviewed his wife, Allison, once. And Scott Stratton once mentioned that he worked, I guess after college, he worked in human resources until he realized he doesn't like people. Scott McCain, on the other hand, seems to really like people.
I do. And Scott Stratton's one of my best pals. And we have talked about that. Matter of fact, he was here in Las Vegas not long ago. We went to breakfast and, you know, we even talk about it. Is that, you know, for me, the best time of a speech is afterwards when now there's something that I can talk one-on-one with the audience about because people come up and say, hey, when you told that story about,
yes,
here's how it, you know, and to engage in that. And my inbox, particularly on LinkedIn, is full all the time with people saying, hey, something happened today that reminded me of the story that you told when you were here. But I love that.
Oh, that's great.
And Scott Stratton, you know, it's just the differences in people, but he wants to be like the rock. You know, Elvis has left the building.
Yes.
Kind of guy.
Yeah.
Which is great because he makes such an impact on audiences. It's just the differences in people.
But and if there's any listeners out there, I want them to reach out to Scott and say hello, tell him you heard this interview because, you know, this isn't his last book. And I'm sure every time he comes out with a new book, he decides, well, whose podcast do I want to come on? I never heard from anybody from that one. So, but the bigger point is you talk about Scott Stratton, Elvis. He has a man bun, but you don't.
I know.
Just something to think about, Scott, you know. Well,
and his beard keeps getting longer and longer.
That's right. Anyway, that's right.
I keep mine pretty trim.
So. Right, right.
It's branding. It's the difference. See, you've got to create a different experience than your competitor.
There you go. So anyway, one last thing I want to mention is that I've seen Jay Baer keynote a few times, and I'm actually going to be interviewing him soon about his new book, but I haven't seen any of the others. I haven't even seen you. And I've often, because I have issues, Scott, and I'm a big fan of people like you, I've often wondered how I could get into one of those private corporate events and like watch you give a keynote, or Scott, or some of these other folks.
You can come as my guest.
Oh, really?
Anytime. Yeah, absolutely.
Scott McCain, I've thought about this, and I recently watched, I think it was a 1995 film, Heat, with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. Right. Yeah. Finally saw it. I'm a little behind. And there's a scene where Robert De Niro, the bad guy, sneaks into a hotel and swipes a hotel employee uniform. So I was thinking, hear me out. I could fly to Vegas and sneak into one of the hotels, steal like a busboy uniform or something, and then go to the room where you're presenting and watch. Now, one problem is that they might actually make me start working. And I was a busboy once, and that is hard work.
Pick up that dish.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
So the other problem is that I'll surely end up accosted by hotel security, but that won't be the first time I've been thrown out of a hotel.
I'll just get you the laminated all-access pass.
Oh, really? Well, thank you.
Like I have those. That's what my music buddies have. Is,
you know, okay. So. Yeah. Well, if I could get that from you, that'd be great. And you do have a couch I can sleep on, right? No, I'm kidding. So,
absolutely. Come to Vegas.
I do want to mention one listener, Ryan Anderson. He is a very loyal Marketing Book podcast listener. Good-looking guy, obviously. It's the same thing. And he makes these hilarious parody videos on LinkedIn. And they're often about books that are on the Marketing Book podcast. So it's really funny. And anyway, he mentioned that you had just finally come out with your book, and I had heard about it, but I think there were some delays. And so then I reached out to you immediately, and we got it all scheduled. And Ryan was like, okay, so I made that happen, right? It's like, yes, Ryan, that's right. You, once again, this interview is happening because of Ryan Anderson. And I told him, I said, it's not because Scott wants to be interviewed by Douglas Burdett. He wants to stay at Ryan Anderson's good side. So, and I respect that. So, there you go. Well,
I'm a fan of both of you.
Thank you.
Obviously, with the bourbon that we shared earlier, it kind of shows I'm a Burdett guy
too. Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for your kind words. Burdett. Well, let's enough about me, as they say. Let's get on to the book. I want to read a couple sections from the beginning and get into it. You write in the dedication, you write, the purpose of this book is to assist you in delivering ultimate customer experiences to your customers and colleagues. All of us are obviously dealing with the changing workplace and challenging workforce precipitated by the COVID-19 pandemic. This means you may be wondering, where should our focus be when the economy is volatile and the marketplace unsettled? The research I've reviewed, combined with my decades of business experience, moves me to conclude that it has never been more important to create compelling engagement with your customers than it is right now. That's why I dedicate this book to you. It's for anyone who strives to create better experiences for customers and colleagues. And then jumping over to page 14, you write, the reason I chose to write this book is because I wanted to share the five fundamental aspects of creating ultimate customer experiences for the clients and prospects you deal with every single day. During this volatile period, as we come to grips with and try to learn how business has been changed forever, the level at which we connect with customers has never been more important. And finally, on page 17, you write, the purpose of this book is to cover some basic steps that we may already know. However, even if we know them, we often fail to consistently implement them. Now, you mentioned before we started recording that your publisher wanted a different kind of book this time. Explain that.
Well, every book that I've written so far has really been geared for leaders of organizations, managers, vice presidents, C-suite, or entrepreneurs, you know, people that own their own business. And Jonathan Merck, who is the founder and publisher at Forefront Books and a longtime icon in the publishing industry, is also a very good friend. And he said, Scott, you know, everything that you've written has been for that level of reader. But for example, a branch manager of a big bank might read iconic, but they wouldn't hand it to the frontline loan officer, and they wouldn't hand it to a teller. And one of the things I believe is that the biggest challenge in distinction and the biggest challenge in the customer experience is that disconnection between what management is planning and the execution that the frontline delivers to customers. He said, I would really challenge you that your next book write something that a manager, a leader would read, or an entrepreneur would read, and then hand that book to their frontline people and say, this is what we need to be doing. This is how we need to be executing for our customers. And so I took the challenge. It's probably why I'm a little more nervous, you know, when this book was released than I have been for any other book, because it really is just the basics of what it takes for any of us, whether we're in, you know, the C-suite, or whether we're frontline at a retailer, or making sales calls on B2B. Here are the things that we really need to do to ensure the experience is compelling and creates the kind of response from our customers that we desire. So that was really the goal, and I hope it's been accomplished. But I appreciate having, for one thing, I appreciate a publisher that will think in terms of how do I challenge an author to write something a little bit outside their wheelhouse of what they've done previously. And also, it's kind of exciting because it really helps me walk the talk, if you know what I mean. And if I'm saying the biggest disconnection is how the frontline actually treats their customers, as opposed to the customer journey maps that are being planned, you know, at the home headquarters, then I need to be delivering information that helps that frontline.
Yes. And Scott, normally when I interview an author, I go kind of chronologically through a book because there's a really good reason why an author wrote a book in a certain order. But yeah, Not for Scott McCain. I want to make an exception here and start with the end in mind, as Stephen Covey might have said, yeah, and ask you about something from the conclusion that really got my attention. And that is, explain the three stages of customer loyalty. And then I want to ask you to explain how that's changing, what's contributing to this lack of loyalty these days.
Well, we see it in television. That's part of what I used as the metaphor in the book, is that it used to be, you know, if you didn't see, let's go in the Wayback Machine, and you know, if you weren't watching Ed Sullivan at a particular time on Sunday nights, then you didn't get to see it at all.
Yes, and I can remember in 1964 watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. Yeah, that's how old I am.
Absolutely, and you know, there you go. But now we don't need to worry about that because we're now loyal to our own schedules and our own, you know, favorite genres. I can go on Netflix and I can, you know, I can watch whatever genre I want at any time I want. The only way we become a customer is to make a choice, right? We make a choice, and as businesses, we tend to think that people choose us. Well, that's true, but that's not the all-encompassing vision. It's that they choose us instead of these other alternatives. And so when loyalty changes, now customers are loyal to a particular show. You know, if I love, let me pick a wild one. If I love Family Guy, I don't have to watch it just on Fox on Sunday nights. It's going to be on the Cartoon Network. It's going to be, or I can set my recorder and I can have every episode of Family Guy ever made because I've recorded it digitally. I am loyal to the show. I am no longer loyal to the network that has, you know, provided it. Okay, so what is that? You know, somebody once said all business is show business. What does that mean to our business?
Which is one of your books.
Yeah. If that's the case in show business, how does that relate to our business, whatever it might be?
Scott, let me interject real quickly here, because you explained that there's three stages, and this kind of sets us up for why one of them is starting to crater. Loyalty stage one is customers that are only interested in transactions. And then loyalty stage two is customers who are kind of loyal. And yeah, then loyalty stage three is customers who are raving fans.
Yeah, they're advocates, right?
Right.
Yeah. As we talked in a previous show, you know, I grew up in a rural community in southern Indiana, Crothersville, Indiana. And when I was a kid, most of the farms in our area were mid-sized family farms. You go back home now and those are gone. They're either small and highly specialized. They grow cantaloupes, watermelon. They have a very specific, you know, specialty crop. or they're enormous. They're farming thousands and thousands of acres. It's the middle that went away. And I see that as a metaphor for what's happening in terms of customer loyalty, is that when you look at customers, they're either price shoppers to some degree or convenience shoppers. They go to Amazon or they go to wherever the cheapest price is, or they're always in play. They're not loyal to you. They're loyal to getting a better deal, or they're loyal to getting a quicker deal, those kinds of things. Or they're extremely loyal. They are so all in with you and who you are because the experience is so frictionless. The experience is so engaging that why mess around with anybody else? So it's that middle that's gone away. Yet for many businesses that I'm dealing with and talking to, they think that middle is their target market and they're not good enough to inspire that kind of loyalty that I was talking about with the shows. We're not delivering an experience that is profound enough and, for lack of a better term, ultimate enough to inspire that degree of loyalty and engagement. I believe there's only two ways that a business grows, and that is that your current customers come back and they buy more from you. It's repeat business. And the other way is your current customers tell other people. They refer you to either their colleagues in business or other people that do what they do at other businesses or their family and friends. I mean, whether it's B2B or B2C, those are the only two ways that you really sustain growth. I mean, there's only so much that we can cut from a budget, but the opportunity to sell and to grow is unlimited. So we're better off on focusing on how do we get our current customers to come back more often and spend more money, and how do we get our current customers to become advocates for us in the marketplace. There's old stories. There was a Business Week story years ago about how Apple was growing their corporate sales, and it was comparing it to Dell that had hundreds, thousands of salespeople that were calling on businesses, but yet more people back then, the Mac was growing as a business computer. And it wasn't because they're salespeople. It's because people had a Mac at home and they wanted to use a Mac at the office. So their customers were driving the growth of the platform as opposed to having a sales force. I think both are important. I think obviously salespeople are critical, but they have to be creating these ultimate experiences as well. I'm on a tangent here, Douglas, but when I first started my speaking business, part of how a lot of us start is to also do seminars for seminar companies. And I did a sales seminar for a particular company, and there was a line in their sales seminar that said, "Service is the first step of the next sale." That is so outdated today, because if I don't have a great customer experience from the first point of contact, even from your website, from your marketing, from your social media, if I don't sense a great customer experience from that, you don't even get a chance to sell me. I mean, it's the first step of the first contact that you have with a prospect today.
And it's pretty accurate. You can get a pretty good sense of how you're going to be treated like a customer based on how they're selling to you. And again, even before that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of the things I do some work in the automotive industry, and that's one of the things I tell dealerships is that, you know, your salespeople are creating the demand for the service department, not only by how many cars they sell, but by the experience they create for their customers. And that's another thing I'm big on is if you think about it, businesses are constructed vertically. We have a sales department, a service department, an accounting department, but customers' experiences horizontally. I don't, if the service department messes up, I don't like the dealership. It's not that I don't like the sales department. I just don't do business with the dealership anymore, because I look at it holistically, where organizationally we're structured departmentally. So everybody has to be in the customer experience game. Everybody has to create the ultimate customer experience.
Yes. And let me ask just one other question before we go back in the proper order for this interview. On page 140, you talk about this concept of poor information and navigation, and that's it's getting harder and harder for folks to find you and your business. Talk about that.
We are so overwhelmed with information that it's really hard to get a tool to give us what we want. I mean, yeah, there's Google, but you know, Google what you do just from a very, you know, generic description of what your business does. And there are so many options available that it's difficult to make the choice, but we do the very same thing internally. There are websites that I go to, Douglas, I think that must have been designed by the sales prevention department.
Well said. Yeah.
It's so hard to get to. And there was a membership of something. I had purchased a membership, and it's not that I want to cancel it forever. It's just that I'm not going to have a need for it for the next 2 or 3 months because of my schedule. So I wanted to cancel, and then I'll come back and do it again. They made it so hard for me to cancel that I decided never to go back and buy it again. There's other places I can go and get that same service. In other words, they made it so inconvenient for me to take care of my business with them that I developed a feeling that they must not care about me, so I won't do business with them anymore. And so we've got to understand that everything we do, there's so many good choices, and loyalty changes so easily and frequently today that if we don't provide great information and make it easy through navigation and everything else for customers to do business with us, they'll just choose someplace else. And if your frontline people are creating friction for me, why wouldn't I go elsewhere? Why do I need to put up with that when there are so many alternatives than ever before?
Yes, it's so true. And I have to laugh because I live in a 1908 house and need to get it, parts of it painted. It's a brick house, but parts of it need to be painted. Yeah. There's a little bit of carpentry that has to be done first. I can't find a carpenter, yeah. But I don't want to hire someone unless I can get a recommendation from somebody I know or can trust. Because it's hard. Again, it's back to the information. But one thing that you mentioned in the book is that 91% of dissatisfied customers will never purchase anything from your company again. So let's get back to the beginning. Scott McCain, what is an ultimate customer experience?
I think one of the things that's really important to emphasize, Douglas, is that's defined by your customer.
Yes. What is a customer?
Right. I mean, you know, and
it's not what a lot of people think.
It's very different from a lot of people think, because a customer is anyone that has contact with you and your organization and your branding and what you do, because they're consuming that even before they've spent a nickel with you. So everything has to be exactly right in everything that we do, even before, you know, we call them prospects in the old days, right? Mm-hmm. But I really think we have to change that definition, because a customer, the root word is consume. And so if someone is consuming our information, if they're consuming what we're putting out there in terms of marketing and advertising and everything else, then they've already spent their time and their attention with us before they spent their money. And if I've got their time and attention in a very compelling manner and through a great customer experience, I can convert that into them spending their money with us.
On page 13, you write that prior to the pandemic, there were abundant conferences that encourage professionals to market more intensely and sell more powerfully. However, even after all we've been through, we still aren't spending nearly enough time talking about how we can serve our colleagues in a more compelling manner or expand a learning program to educate our team on how to attain a higher level of customer retention. Why is that still the case, do you think?
I wish I had an answer for that, Douglas. I bought the URL. I let it go because I didn't do anything with it. But I bought the URL, No Bro Sales, because I am so tired of this bro crush the competition.
Oh, yes.
I am so tired and done with that.
Yes, and there's a strong strain of it on LinkedIn too.
Oh, huge. Yeah, you're exactly right. Huge. And I... Golly. It
no bro sales. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, seriously. I mean, who buys that? I saw one talking about how to, and it wasn't overcome. I forget the word that he used, but it was almost like dominate when there's an objection. well, I don't want to dominate my customer. I want to engage with my customer. Who, except for a very kinky few, who pays for domination? You know, I don't want to be dominated by my car dealer. I don't want to be dominated by my insurance agent. I don't want to be dominated by my financial advisor. I want to have a relationship with them. And profitability also, by the way, it's inherent in what we talked about earlier. Profitability is based on long-term repetitive relationships. Very few businesses make it when they're constantly churning through customers. So how do you do that in an area where it's all about push, 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 sell, sell, sell? And don't get me wrong. I mean, sales are important, but every statistic that I've seen from really valid surveys suggests that the reason customers spend money with us and they come back and spend more and they refer us is because we create great experiences, not because we're out there in a total hustle, dominate, kill the competition mode.
Always be closing.
So Scott McCain, you write on page 19, organizations and their leaders frequently make a similar mistake. They create extensive customer journey maps, yep, schedule training and customer service, market and promote their customer experience, and do all of this without a clear customer philosophy in place. Explain what you mean by customer philosophy, because it really is like the foundation for building a house. And yet, too many companies jump straight to the tactics.
Yeah, they really do. Let me insert real quickly too that part of my challenge with customer journey maps is that if you or I go on a journey, it means there is a destination. There's an endpoint. And I don't ever want that with my customers. I want to continue to find new ways to serve my clients so that it's as another old movie was titled, The Never-Ending Journey, right? As opposed to what we think about journey. So that whole concept of the journey map, to me, has a significant flaw because it means there's going to be an endpoint with us and our customers, which I don't think most of us really want. But philosophy is that, you know, that attitude or that approach that guides how we act. It's our guiding principles. So we have to have these guiding principles of who we are and what we stand for and what our philosophy is about customers, that we then, once that's in place, then that influences our culture. The culture drives our strategy, and then the strategy drives the tactics. It's a through line. But if the philosophy isn't in place, it's like building a house without a foundation. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody has to know that this is our commitment. This is our philosophy. This is how we approach customers. And I know some folks will think, well, that's soft. That's not. But yet, think of the companies. You know, I would suggest, I'm going to use some cliches because they're universally known. Too many people talk about it, but they're universally known. But, you know, Amazon has a different customer philosophy than Apple. That's great. But that's part of what differentiates them in the marketplace. But knowing what that philosophy is internally then lets them create a better strategy that leads to better tactics and leads to a unique experience.
Well, before we wrap up, I want to jump through the five steps here briefly, which is very unfair to you, but come on. A few questions I want to ask. And let's talk about step one, which is don't make it right, get it right. You write two of the most critical points that anyone can make about the customer experience are your customer does not want you to make it right. Your customer wants you to get it right. Now, these two ideas sound rather similar, but they are quite different, actually. Explain.
Well, if I go and I'm flying from Vegas to Atlanta, you know, I don't want Delta to make it right. I don't want them to say, oh, sorry, we had to cancel your flight. The flight crew, you know, didn't have enough hours, or the plane is dirty. Sorry, we didn't have enough time to clean it. Or, I mean,
that's, see, we're not going to get you to Atlanta. Basically, right? That's what you wanted.
Yeah, basically, yeah, yeah. But you know, I'm sorry, we didn't train our pilot. You know, they landed. They landed in Lexington, Kentucky instead.
Yeah.
We have to focus on getting it right for our customer. An example that we've all been through is, you know, you set in line, you go through the drive-through, and they give you the wrong order. So now you either have to park and take it in, or you end up eating what you didn't order, or you get back in line and have to go back through the drive-thru, and they'll make it right. I mean, they'll eventually give you what you ordered.
But they didn't get it right.
But they didn't get it right.
Yeah.
And they're making it right. And how many times do we see this? I talked about this in depth in the book Iconic, but we see organizations that will placate the customer. Oh, we'll make it right, thinking that that's okay. But what they're doing is not fixing the problem. We've got to look at our systems. We have to look at our processes and our procedures and say, how do we get it right every single time? That's the goal, that we're not going to make it right because we're not going to have to. We're going to get it right for customers. Look at the places where you do business. And I bet the places where you are loyal, because that's what we're trying to inspire, is customer loyalty. The places that are loyal are the ones that you don't have to go back to and say, oh, you know, you messed this one up. Can you fix it? They're the ones that get it right. It just works. They just take care of me. They answer their phones. They do the things that get it right every time, rather than having to, you know, insincerely apologize and offer to make it right.
Yeah, there was a book on the show this year that was by Bill Price. And the book is called The Frictionless Organization. He had worked at Amazon for a number of years. And one of the interesting things that he writes about in the book is that these really smart organizations like Amazon, they see a complaint, and rather than rushing off to solve the complaint, which they do, they also ask, why did this happen in the first place? Why did the customer have to contact us? The customers don't really want to have to contact us. You don't want to have to pull off into the parking lot at the fast food place. So yeah, so they're getting it right. Now, you started to touch on something. I think you ought to, at the risk of being too basic, but there's a clarification that needs to happen. You write that part of the problem is that we have three terms that mean different things but are used somewhat interchangeably, and they are customer satisfaction, customer service, and customer experience. I was wondering if you could just shed some light on that for folks who are listening who might be able to help their organizations understand the difference when they hear these words being used interchangeably at the conference room.
Well, the story that I tell, as you know, Douglas, is, you know, I get down on one knee. I've got the little box with the diamond ring in it behind my back. I'm about to propose to my wonderful wife, Tammy. And if I would have looked up at her and looked her in the eye and said, sweetheart, what do you think about our relationship? If she would have gone, yeah, you know, I guess I'm satisfied. That's not the time to propose, right? I mean, satisfaction would be a miserable standard at that point. Yet for some reason, we do customer satisfaction studies. We go for customer satisfaction. Satisfied just means, yeah, you know, I'm satisfied. It's not bad. Are we loyal to things that merely satisfy us? We get loyal to the things that amaze us and thrill us and knock us out. Mm-hmm. So service means that we've eliminated some of the friction. You know, we answered the phone in a reasonable number of rings. You didn't put me on hold for 45 minutes and have recorded announcements telling me how important my business is to you, even though you've got me on hold for God knows how long.
And how important my call is.
Yes, exactly. Your call is so important that we're not going to answer it here for another hour and a half.
Right.
I mean, those kinds of things drive me crazy, right? Because that service is, you know, it's the things that eliminate the friction from the process of doing business with you. Satisfaction means, yeah, you didn't screw up. Yeah, you're all right. It's a low standard, but the experience engages the customer at an emotional level. And we're only loyal to those things that create emotion. Why would I be loyal to something I don't care about? So when we engage the customer, whether it's in a B2B or B2C level, when we engage the customer and get emotion involved, now we've created an experience, and the experience is what drives the loyalty that all of us want in our respective positions.
And with that in mind, before we wrap up this first part, you write that there are three levels of customer interaction, which are processing, service, and experience. And processing are the basic elements of the transaction, kind of like getting the order right at the drive-thru. Basically, what the customer has a right to expect you to deliver, like getting you to Atlanta when you bought a ticket to Atlanta.
Yeah. Okay, we didn't crash. We didn't.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I went to, and I know you're an Indianapolis Colts fan. I went to a Bengals game last year, and we flew on Delta, and we had to catch connecting flights going there and coming back to the East Coast. And they left on time. They arrived on time. None of the passengers on the plane were fighting. It was completely uneventful. And afterwards, when I got home, I thought, wow, that was great. Good on you, Delta. You know? So anyway, level two is the, what you say, the steps that we take to assist, engage, and serve the customer with empathy. And this prevents the elements of the first part from feeling impersonal and robotic. And then level three is experience. And this is sort of enhancing the interaction you have with the customer so they think of it as personal and emotional. And we may come back to the level two and the three in a minute, but say more about processing. And if you would, tell the story of your friend, Captain Charlie Plum.
Oh, gosh. I was with Charlie last weekend, in fact. Charlie Plum was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 6 years and tortured and all the things beyond, you know, beyond what most of us can.
And he was a pilot, an F-4 pilot, who was shot down in combat.
Exactly right. Shot down over North Vietnam and held and tortured and captured for over 6 years. And if you remember when those prisoners of war were released, they were kind of instant celebrities. We as a nation, regardless of how we felt about the Vietnamese conflict, we're very proud of their service and what they had done and the experience that they'd had. So they became like local celebrities. And so Charlie was used to, at that particular point in his home area of Kansas City, of having people come up and shake his hand and introduce themselves and all of that. And he's in a diner by himself in a small Kansas town. And a man came up and said, I believe that you're Captain Plum. And he said, yes, I am. And then the man revealed, he said, I was on the same aircraft carrier as you. I served with you. And Charlie kind of realized that the, you know, these jet pilots, these top guns were kind of separated from the rest of the group. And he said, in fact, I packed your parachute that day that you were shot down. And Charlie had the, said the blinding flash of the obvious, that overwhelming realization is that the reason that he was able to come home, even after those years of suffering, the reason he was alive is because that man did his job. He got it exactly right. He did the processing part. He packed the parachute perfectly. So it worked in a manner that when he needed it, it saved Charlie's life. And one of the things that Charlie asks in his book, I'm No Hero, and the ask of his audiences when he speaks is, you know, who is packing your parachute? And if you're a leader, if you are a manager, are you encouraging and helping and making certain that the folks that are packing parachutes are doing it exactly right every time so that they deliver what your customer not only has a right to expect, but also might need to work perfectly in a difficult situation. And that story always just, man, there are a few stories I've heard from author speakers that have impacted me as much as Charlie's story about packing parachutes, but it is the perfect example of processing. That sailor did his job exactly right. And it saved the life of a man who has inspired, you know, untold thousands of people with his respective story.
Right. And you write that every organization has parachute packers. And of course, I had to chuckle to myself because every time I jumped out of an airplane when I was in the Army with a parachute, each time, coincidentally, yeah, perfectly good airplanes that went on to land. So there was really no reason to jump out, but you know, the Army has a certain way of doing things. I never worried about my parachute opening properly. Do you know why?
No.
Because the Army has a process whereby you cannot become a parachute packer until you're airborne qualified, you've gone through, and you're capable of jumping. Every parachute packer, they're called riggers, they pack their parachutes, and their name is on them, and they put them in their own pile, and then they are randomly, during the day, told to put on one of the parachutes they just packed and to get on the airplane that's right outside the building on the landing strip.
Oh, wow.
So talk about accountability. Those riggers know that parachute, they're going to be randomly selected and they're going to have to put one on and make it work. So that's I thought that was a great story.
So they get it right every time.
They get it right every single time because they're going to have to jump with it. It's like my friend who was a helicopter pilot or a helicopter mechanic in the Army. Guess who had to get on the helicopter when they first took it up after he'd worked on it? He had to go on the helicopter as well. So there was all kinds of motivation built in there. So I also have to add that you said that the pilots were the naval aviators were kept away from the rest of the sailors. And I have a lot of friends who are or were naval aviators. And the reason the Navy does that is to protect the other sailors from the naval aviators. Tell Charlie I said that.
I will do that.
So step two is making a great impression. And again, you know, maybe Scott McCain feels like he's taking crazy pills, but why do so many professionals fail to understand the impact our impressions make?
Douglas, I'm with you. It is beyond me. But I also think it's getting worse, and I don't mean to be negative, but I think with everything that's going on in the world today, with, you know, when we're taking pictures of every meal that we're eating in a restaurant and sharing it with the world, and, you know, here I am in front of this, you know, monument, here I am on vacation, here I am, you know, that we are creating this feeling that it's all about me, and we don't realize that great impressions are made when we do our job to present the best that we can do for the customer, not for ourselves and our own self-aggrandizement. It's for the customer. And for some reason, we're getting a bigger disconnection that everything I do, it must be okay because I'm going to do what I want to do, not taking into account the impression that might make on whether it's an internal or external customer that we're making on.
And we're going to talk about taking responsibility for yourself, but what do you say to people who are working and don't have the same dedication to customers as say you do?
Well, it depends of course on the organization, but the right thing to say is goodbye. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, if somebody on our team isn't committed to serving customers, then they need to have the opportunity to display that philosophy at a competitor rather than with us. But in many cases, they just haven't been made aware that this is so important. Mm-hmm. So here's the critical question. And it's one of the things I talk about in the book. There's a critical question that we need to teach our people to be asking themselves. And that simple question is this: if I were being taken care of as a customer, exactly as I am treating this customer, would it make me feel good about doing business here? Mm. And when we ask ourselves that question, you know, if I was being treated the way I'm treating this customer, would I really feel good about doing business here? It might open our perspective. It might change our opinion about what serving the customer means and how connecting with the customer can make a difference.
There was another book on the show recently where the author was saying, you know, Would you treat your grandmother this way?
Yeah.
Or Jean Bliss, who you know.
Yeah, Jean Bliss. Would you do that to your mother?
She wrote a book called Would You Do That to Your Mother, which was a brilliant customer experience book. So
it's a great book.
Before we move on to step three, I've never been to Jacksonville, Florida, although I do have a college buddy there who has Jacksonville Jaguar season tickets. So I might go off him for a weekend sometime. And if I get to Jacksonville, I'm going to look for Taxi Terry. Great. Tell us about Taxi Terry.
I love telling the story. It's kind of the signature story of my speeches. The incredible cab driver who picked up, you know, me, this tired late flight, you know, just get me to the hotel, get me out of here passenger, greeted me by saying, "Are you ready for the best cab ride of your life?" And then delivered it. It's just an amazing, amazing way that you could take a business that you would think would be impossible to differentiate. I mean, Uber is disrupting the industry. How do you tell one cab driver from another? How do you differentiate a ride and made it unique and compelling so that I became a loyal customer every time I got to Jacksonville? And I've told the story to thousands upon thousands of people, and I know have referred a lot of folks to do business with Taxi Terry. simply because he found a way to create this ultimate customer experience. Everything from, you know, having it so I could see what the weather was going to be for my trip. By the way, I could have looked it up on my own phone, but he was thinking of ways to provide something unexpected and unique and compelling for customers. He just created this amazing ultimate customer experience by finding ways to connect on the things that mattered to customers through recording their names and then putting it in his CRM for a cab driver with CRM, so that he would remember the name of your kids and where they were going to school and what they were doing. And then if you would reserve a ride, he would prepare that. So he knows his customers in a way that creates an incredible experience. It's just amazing. And people go, oh, how great for a cab driver. That's not the point. If I can get that experience from a guy taking me from the airport to the Marriott, why wouldn't I expect that of my financial advisor? Why wouldn't I expect that of a company that I'm doing a B2B transaction with that might be hundreds of thousands of dollars? If they can't deliver what Taxi Terry delivers, then why do they deserve my business?
They don't. Let's jump to step three, which is serve with empathy, which I think could probably mean something different to everybody who hears this. But explain what you mean as it relates to serving the customer. What does that mean?
Yeah, empathy is the act of identifying with their feelings. It doesn't mean sympathy. You know, you feel sorry for them, or you know, you get overly emotionally involved. But it means that, you know, you care about how they feel. You care about what their challenges are. You care about what the friction is in the relationship in the past. So it's how we get to that experience level, because I don't think that you can create the emotion that we've talked about if you don't serve with empathy. But to take it the next step, Douglas, is to really break it down. All three words are important. You know, serve is how do we be of service to the people that we want to do business with us. But when you say with, it also implies that doing service isn't enough. There has to be something with that to accomplish what we want. And then empathy is that critical question. You know, if am I serving them in the way that they want to be served? How do I do this? I write in the book the story of Bert Bachman, who said we cannot work just for a paycheck. What we're really there for is to serve our customer with empathy. So I ask folks, you know, other than compensation, what do you work for? And I find that the folks that find meaning and value out of serving and helping their customers, you can't do that without being empathetic of what their challenges, what their problems, what their opportunities, all of that. That takes it to a higher level where we all want to have that kind of experience.
Yes, you're right. People do not want customer service as much as they desire customer empathy. They want to feel like you understand them. Scott, tell us the story of the 17-year-old in Texas who sold newspaper subscriptions for his summer job back in the 1980s. And I'm not going to say his name because that's the big reveal.
Yeah, that's the tell. Yeah, he's 17 years old and he's a newspaper delivery boy, but he took it the next level. He thought, you know, how do I serve my customers better? Well, part of that, you know, is making sure, and it's something we take for granted now, but wasn't done back then. You know, we make sure that on a rainy day, it was wrapped and delivered on the porch. It was getting to know his customers' names and where they wanted the newspapers placed. But he also did things like, and this is in the pre-internet days, he also did things like go to the county courthouse to find out where the new residents were, you know, who'd bought a house and moved into a new house in the neighborhood. And then he would go to that house and knock on the door and introduce himself and, you know, talk about, boy, you know, getting the newspaper every day means you get to know your community and you get to know this area and how can I serve you? And he would want to know how, you know, what he could do to serve them better. So he wasn't just throwing paper in the front yard. He was getting
with a list he had been given. He was actually building his own list.
He built his own list. Yeah. And he expanded his list. Well, by, you know, at the end of a particular year, he was number one in the company. He was number one in the entire Dallas area. And his service with empathy is what, you know, kept people subscribing and got new subscribers and got the word of mouth in neighborhoods. And he was the most successful at that. So he goes to college and he thinks, well, what if I apply that approach in, you know, making certain that we create exactly what customers need. So he thought, what if we built computers the way that customers wanted them, rather than having you just order what's off the shelf? Because that newspaper boy's name was Michael Dell.
And he started it in the dorm room at the University of Texas.
Yeah.
Dell Computers.
Yeah. Is that amazing?
It is. It's great. It's such a great example. This is where I get all emotional, okay? Step four is connect with emotion. Now, we talked earlier about level one, which is processing, the story of Charlie Plum, parachute packing. And on page 94, you write that when I say we need to connect with emotion, I'm not suggesting we become a pushover, right, weeping and wailing with customers over their personal situations. Connecting emotionally does not mean we engage in an overly intimate or inappropriate way. Right. Tell us about the accident you had in New York City in a Hertz rental car to explain what you mean by connecting with emotion.
So I'd never driven in Manhattan before. And it's as crazy as it sounds, I think it's part of the way that you get the most out of visiting and exploring in a community. So I got a Hertz rental car, and I'd given my speech, and it was the middle of the day, so the traffic wasn't as bad as you might expect in Manhattan. And I'm cruising to turn my Hertz car back into LaGuardia, and this flatbed truck in front of me in clear traffic all of a sudden just locks up the brakes, and I rear-ended it. Airbag goes off. I go up, make sure the guy that I hit was okay. He was fine. I call 911. Police come out.
There's airbag dust all over your suit?
Yeah. You know, and I dust myself off, and I find my iPhone under the deflated airbag, and I call 911, and the police are on their way. Now I realize there's another call I got to make. If you've ever rented a car, you know on the ticket jacket it says, if you're in an accident, first call the police and then call us, right? So then call Hertz. So I call the number from Hertz. Never had to do this before in my life. She answers on the first ring. Hertz, how may I help you? Now, I've just been in an accident. I'm shook up. I'm robotic. I've got to get through this. And I robotically read my rental record number, and I've been involved in an accident at this mile marker. I've called the police, but I need to get a wrecker here to tow this car away. I hope to get a ride to the airport, catch a later flight home. Oh, and she interrupts. She says, "Mr. McCain," and I realized I hadn't told her my name. I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, I've got everything from the rental record number that you've given me, all the info. But sir, first of all, are you okay?" But I'm still on autopilot. I'm like, yeah, but I need a record, this mile marker. I need to get a ride to there. And she said, "Well, sir, excuse me for saying this, but you don't sound like you're okay. Are you certain that you are all right?" So for the first time since the wreck, you know, I take a deep breath and I get my wits about me and try to get my head together. And I said, "Ma'am, physically I'm fine, but I am really shook up. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." And she audibly exhales and goes, "Oh, that is so great. Because you see, sir, Hertz can always get another car. We can never get another Mr. McCain." And my response was, I didn't mean to wreck. I'm so sorry. Right. Hertz convinced me at that instant that they cared more about me than their car. That created an emotional connection. And I'm a Hertz customer for life. I never rent from anybody else. Avis is a buck cheaper. I don't care. You know, Hertz has already proven to me that I'm more important to them than their cars. And by the way, I've been telling, as we talked about earlier, I've been telling that story from the stage for a long time. And I've had, at this point, I think it's 7 people come up to me and say, you know, I wrecked a Hertz car and they did exactly the same thing with me too. So in other words, it wasn't that I won the lottery and got the one sympathetic, you know, operator that day. It is that's company policy, you know?
Right. So you call in and you said, "I wrecked the car," and they didn't say, "What the hell is the matter with you? What are you drunk?"
Right. Yeah, exactly. What are you doing to our car?
Well, you better get us a new car.
Yeah. Right. You'll never rent from us again.
Right. Oh, great. Let's jump to the last one, which is to take personal responsibility, which I mentioned earlier. Now, Scott, it's a great book, but this is my favorite section of the book. And the only reason is because you talk about a guy named Doug. Yeah. And it's not me, okay?
But they're all the same, don't you think? Well,
thank you. Thank you. By the way, did you know there's a guy named Doug running for president of the United States? And I don't know his last name, but I heard there's a guy named Doug. And you know what, Scott McCain? There has never been a president named Scott or Doug.
Or Doug,
so
yes.
This could be our time. Actually, I think you'd probably have a good shot at becoming president. I will definitely not do that. But anyway, enough about Doug. Tell us a story that involves Doug as it relates to taking personal responsibility. And honestly, that this kind of goes back to what I talked about earlier about what if you're working with employees that just don't give a damn?
Yeah, yeah. Doug is a guy that certainly made an impression because he took personal responsibility, but and made an extra effort. We were, my wife and I were checking in a hotel, and the bellman, you know, it's all the steps we talked about. He got it right. He got level one processing. He served with empathy. He connected with emotion. But we're in Hawaii, and my wife had never been to a luau. So we go to the luau, and there's a guy with a name tag. It said Doug.
Oh, but wait. There was another hotel you all went to first.
Oh, yeah. We had a horrible experience there on several levels.
And these were both nice places. These are both places that had great real estate.
Great places. They had beautiful, I mean, it was gorgeous to look out. It was great. But the experience at the first hotel was soiled. And Hertz came through for me there again and resolved a difficult situation with that first hotel. But now we go to another hotel, right?
But you're never going back to that first one. I mean, it really was a nightmare. Yeah.
Right. Never going back. I mean, again, there's enough options. We don't have to, right? There's a lot of places with nice real estate there.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we go to the second hotel, and we're going to the luau, and there's this guy there, Doug's on the name tag, and he didn't just say, welcome to the luau. He asked our names, and, you know, how do we like it? How long have we been in Hawaii? What are we doing? All that kind of thing. Just really engaging. We thought, yeah, well, okay. It's already better than the last hotel. Now, the next morning, we get up, we go to the gym, we're going to go, hey, let's get a smoothie. Now, Doug's behind the bar, and as we walk up, he says, hey, it's the McCains, good morning. He remembered our name. And then the next morning, it wasn't just it's the McCains. The next morning is, oh, it's Scott and Tammy. And we had a conversation with him, and he said, now, please know, you know, we know the hotel needs some renovation, and we're moving upscale. We're going to become it within this particular chain. We're moving to a more elite brand. But you know, part of what we understood was that hotel was already elite because of Doug. I'm sure the carpet will be newer and the chandeliers might be brighter on our next stay when we go back to Princeville. But the hotel to us was already elite because Doug made it that way. And it's the people that take personal responsibility for the engagement with the customer that create ultimate customer experiences.
Let me just ask one other question related to that. You write about presenting a speech once on customer service to a major company. Of course, I'm talking to Scott McCain. And you said a chief financial officer told you later that the content of your speech had nothing to do with him.
Yeah.
And he said he had no customer responsibilities. And you as well as your reader, couldn't believe someone with such a limited perspective had attained, you know, such a high position. So if I know there are some CFOs who listen to this show. If he or someone like him is listening to this interview, please explain why they have really missed the mark.
Pardon my directness, but where the hell's the finances coming from, if not from customers? If you're chief financial officer, guess where the money is coming from? Guess where the finances are coming from? It's because customers are choosing to do business with you. You get rid of the customers. We also can get rid of the CFO because we're done. We're broke. We're out of here, right? So for everybody is involved in the customer experience, and everybody is involved with customers. And if we don't understand that, how in the world do we have a business? So if you're a chief financial officer, one of the things you have to be very concerned, because again, I mean, it's like we talked about earlier, where does profitability come from? It basically comes from repeat and referral business. I mean, when we look at companies that are cutting themselves in terms of, you know, cutting budgets, cutting workforces, some just do that in a death spiral. An example, example, a lot of people don't even remember this anymore. Douglas, I know you and I will. It's Circuit City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Circuit City was one of the books that one of the companies that Jim Collins cited in his book Good to Great as one of the great companies, and they went into a death spiral. But how did they do that? Well, they decided we're going to cut our overhead by letting go of our longest higher salaried employees. So they got rid of the people that worked there for a while, which meant now you went in and nobody knew what the heck they were talking about.
Yeah, it's like they got rid of the Dougs.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what they did. They got rid of the Dougs. And so now you went in and you dealt with these idiots named Scott who didn't know how the things worked that you wanted help with or which one was the best one to buy, because they just – and so then what happened? Well, then it goes down. So they're not getting as much business. So now that again, which meant now you couldn't even – not only had they let Doug go, now they let Scott – you couldn't find anybody to wait on him. And so people went to Best Buy, or people started buying from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And Circuit City blamed the economy.
Mm.
No, you didn't do what it took to get customers to repeat and refer your business. And I just see this with so many organizations. They think that the way that they get to profitability is to keep slicing and cutting. And, you know, I heard a very fascinating thing. I just did a meeting for LPL Financial Services, and one of the other speakers said, you know, there's a limit to how much of the existing money I have that I can save, but there is no limit to how much I can make. And I think organizations need to be thinking that way as well. What if we expanded what we're making, as opposed to, you know, Tom Peters said it many years ago, you can't cut your way to greatness. So what we have to do is to encourage our teams to take personal responsibility for enhancing the ultimate customer experience, so that we view our income as being practically limitless.
Yes, and at the end of the book, you talk about something which you touched on earlier, is that great results happen for your organization when you take personal responsibility. However, it pales in comparison to the return you will receive individually for doing so. Talk about how good it feels.
Gosh, I talk to – that's one of the great blessings of my life, is getting to talk to people who have customers that thank them for the difference that they've made in their lives. And, you know, when I was a kid and I was working in radio through high school, a boss always used to say, you know, the reason we play the same songs over and over is because people call in a request. And I said, yeah, but what about all those other people out there? They might not want to hear. He said, no, you don't understand. For every person that will call and request a song, there are hundreds of others that want to hear it again, but won't pick up the phone. And that really made an impression on me the last till today, is that there are some clients that will express that appreciation. And what we have to understand is that for every customer, every client that will express it, hopefully there are many, many more who have benefited from the goodness that we leave in our wake. And that becomes one of the greatest things that we can accomplish, whatever our career might be, is to know that we've made a difference in the lives of other people.
Amen. Scott, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
That thing that you cited earlier, Douglas, that we will take personal responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I see that eroding to some degree. You know, the waiter blames the kitchen. You know, the flight attendant blames the pilot. You know, everybody wants to say it's somebody else's fault, or it's not my department, or it's not my area. At the end of the day, what we as customers want is for you to own our problem, for you to fix what we need fixing, to solve what's going on. And if we would take personal responsibility and then help others understand, others on our team understand why that's so important for them to take personal responsibility. A few years back, I was doing a program for Disney, and I got to meet somebody that actually worked the day that Disneyland opened. And he remarked about seeing Walt Disney walking through before the park opened for the first time and noticing that there was a wrapper from something that was on the ground, and how Walt Disney bent over and picked up the wrapper and put it in a trash can. And he said, to Walt, it seemed like nothing, but for me, it changed everything, because if the owner of the place can pick up a wrapper, what excuse do I have to walk by one?
Mm. Yes. Oh, that's great.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it really is. Leadership by example.
Yeah, exactly.
What's one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book, just to get them thinking about it and doing something?
Yeah, take that personal responsibility. There's an old poem that says they'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. And I think that's so true. We judge you and interpret how we should behave by how our leaders act and behave. So let's face it, it's leaders that listen to podcasts like this. And so when we exemplify that philosophy that we talked about earlier, when we exemplify the values that we seek our company to implement, when we exemplify that through our consistent behavior, that's the best thing that we can do to inspire others to act and behave in that particular way.
Oh, so true. Well, Scott, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
You know, we were talking about one right before we went on. I have not read Joy Coleman's latest book on Never Lose an Employee Again. I love Never Lose a Customer Again. It's brilliant. So I'm really looking forward to reading Joy's newest book, because I just think he is brilliant. And gosh, so many businesses are saying to me, how do we prevent turnover? How do we keep employees? And I know that Joy will have just incredible insights on that. And I know that you recently interviewed him and posted. I'm going to go back and listen to that interview as well, because, you know, both you and Joy are fabulous folks, and I want to hear what you've got to say. So that's one I'm really, really looking forward to reading soon. And one I just recently reread is Jay Baer's Talk Triggers, which is what a brilliant book. And Jay's just as good as it gets. So those are two books. One I haven't read that I'm looking forward to reading, and one that I'd already read that I just pulled back off the shelf and read again.
Yes, and I recently read Josh Bernoff's book, Build a Better Business Book, and in it, he talks about the Talk Triggers book as an example of a great book. He breaks it down as to all the steps that Jay went through. As for Joey Coleman, you, sir, will not be disappointed. And we mentioned this in the interview with him, where I said, you know, over the years, particularly more recently, I've had more companies say, you know, I don't actually need more business. I need more employees.
Yeah.
And this book is such a great issue for that. But also, your employees have more to do with your marketing than anything you can possibly say about your company. That's the biggest part of marketing, is your employees.
Absolutely.
And your customers, what your customers say about you.
I got to tell you real quickly. I used to be involved in a business, and it was just a straight manufacturing business. I was on their board, and we decided to try an experiment, which was we let the employees become the HR department, and we said, we want to hire people that you recommend. You're great. So how do we get more people like you? Well, first of all, I said the right thing to the employees, right? I mean, we appreciate you. Second thing is, I was sitting in a meeting one time, you know, because I wanted to learn more about the company. And one employee turned to another and said, "Hey, Bob, I, your brother's out of work." Why? And he said, "Oh, no, we don't want my brother here. He won't be like us." And so it became self-selecting. So they started bringing in, you know, good people hang with good people. So one of the things I think it's often overlooked is your employees can be the greatest source of who your new employees are, because if you become the kind of, it's just like customers. You want customers to refer you. You want your employees to refer, you know, come work with where I'm working because I love it here. That's the ultimate customer experience from an internal standpoint, not just an external
one. Yes, there's such a brilliant set of parallel paths of never lose a customer again, never lose an employee again. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have mentioned, and your site and your LinkedIn profile and your Twitter account. And I'm going to include a link to the book's website, ultimatecustomerexperience.com. And there's a training program associated with that. And then there's also Distinction Nation, which people can join for free for a bunch of free resources.
You bet. And you get slides that I use in my speech. You get a free course on personal distinction. What does it take to help yourself stand out? a lot of free resources there that we want to provide to help people, you know, go from where they are to where they want to be.
Well, very generous of you. Now, I want to say a word to you, dear listener. Please, please reach out to Scott in some way. Congratulate him on the 9th book and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast, for returning. And guests on the show have told me that they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners, Scott, are so ridiculously good looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the episode's website link. The book is The Ultimate Customer Experience, 5 Steps Everyone Must Know to Excite Your Customers, Engage Your Colleagues, and Enjoy Your Work. The author is Scott McCain. Scott, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, Douglas, you are the best, and I hope that we can share a bourbon in person sometime before too long.
Absolutely. You had me at bourbon. And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."